I'm Bert Cohen. This is The Bert Cohen Show. And this is the United States of America. We are all citizens of the United States of America. And we have a foreign policy here, which affects everybody in the world, actually. Of course, the only people who can vote for president are American citizens. But boy, the stakes are really high for the rest of the world. And one of the biggest conflicts that's gone on basically forever, well, at least since 1948, has been the struggle between the modern state of Israel and the state that used to be there, Palestine, which was at the time really owned by Britain. And it's been complicated ever since then. And all of the struggles that we hear about, just it seems like most of them, the terrorist actions across the world, somehow seem to all come back to the struggle between the Palestinians and the government of the state of Israel. And a lot is happening right now on this issue. It was on May 15th, the anniversary of what the Palestinians call the Akbar, which is that's the catastrophe, I believe it's loosely translated as. It was the founding of Israel and in 1948. And right now, there's a lot going on. Big ads have been taken out in newspapers. There's new different groups. AIPAC has been the most powerful force on American-Israeli policy ever since 1948. Extremely powerful. And there is a rally May 21st through the 24th called Move Over AIPAC. And it's a conference in Washington, D.C., and there's a lot that can be done by American citizens to perhaps change U.S. policy to something that can maybe protect and ensure a secure state of Israel and guarantee some justice for the Palestinians. Our guest today, I'm very pleased to have Jesse Bacon. Jesse, thanks for being with us on The Bert Cohen Show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Bert.
Well, who you are is a former board member of the Jewish Voice for Peace, the editor of Only Democracy, a blog, and a member of Young, Jewish, and Proud. Well, first off, what is Jewish Voice for Peace? And tell us how that came into existence right now as compared to AIPAC, and then let's go right into what the heck AIPAC is.
Great. Well, Jewish Voice for Peace is the fastest growing national Jewish peace group with a framework of human rights. And it really, you know, talk about humble beginnings. It started, I think we had our bar mitzvah year a couple of years back in people's living rooms. It originated in the Bay Area, and it's grown now to, there's 100,000 people who receive our emails. We have thousands of people support us through their generous financial gifts as well as their volunteering. We have a leadership core of about a couple hundred active members who gathered in my city of Philadelphia. So it's really grown beyond. I mean, I've been with the group since 2005 in one capacity or another, and so it's great to see it take off and get this much-deserved recognition, and it's also very humbling. I mean, we know that we're part of a much larger movement, that there are people who face certainly much more physical risks than we do, but very much for the same values of democracy, equality, you know, things that apply to Israelis, Palestinians, and in our own Jewish communities here at home.
Uh-huh. So what is AIPAC, and why is this conference being called Move Over AIPAC. Tell us, not everybody knows what AIPAC is. It's amazing they've had so much power in Congress for so long, and it seems like if you're running for Congress in the last 40, 50 years or so, you had to, if you wanted to make it into Congress, you had to do what AIPAC wanted. Tell us about American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee.
Well, it's one of the most powerful lobbies. It's certainly not the only powerful lobby. I mean, we've all seen kind of efforts of the oil companies or the weapons industry. All of them, they're unelected and they exercise huge influence over our democracy. I mean, I think I would be selling them short if I said that they weren't powerful and influential. I mean, and they are particularly concerning to me because there's an implication that they speak for Jewish Americans. So if they were just powerful lobby X, Y, or Z, but, you know, they represented a group that didn't have such profound sympathies among the part of the American public. I mean, with good reason, there's a lot of great achievements in my community that I'm very proud of, and I don't want to see those things that I love put in the service of something that I'm so opposed to, that so offends my Jewish values and also my American values. And so AIPAC, it's funny, they have PAC in their name. There's basically what they do is they serve as a conduit for political contributions to candidates that back the increasingly hard line of the Israeli government. And so they, I believe they're actually been around since the 60s, and there was a forerunner organization of them that was actually shut down over various like legal concerns. But I'm not so well versed on that history. But so they've managed, they are one of the forces distorting our foreign policy, though not the only one. And Move Over AIPAC is about making room for a new voices, a more diverse Jewish community, a more engaged American people on the issue of foreign policy, and all these voices that are being crowded out but are getting increasingly louder. And I'm really excited to be in Washington, D.C. this weekend on the ground as part of that.
And AIPAC has, well, it's interesting, their title, AIPAC, it sounds like AIPAC, a political action committee. But as they'll be the first to tell you, they're not a political action committee. They're a public affairs committee. And there's a significant difference there. And it's very, very intentional. How does that serve AIPAC's advantage by not being a political action committee, but being a public affairs committee? They can work a little bit differently because of that difference.
Yeah, and I don't know the legalities of it, but just as a person interested in language, it's sort of striking to me. I think PACs have kind of a negative image, and they're often called, you know, single issue voters. That's like a really bad thing to be. And I think public affairs, you know, is, you know, we're all interested in public affairs. We all want to participate in them. But I really think that, you know, it really is this narrow interest, and that's what we need to keep highlighting, that whatever they call it, this is not a Jewish interest, or even I believe an Israeli interest. I mean, I think it's a narrow group of people who believe that, you know, Israel's policies at their most hard line are what should be supported, and they have made it so that the Congress is almost unanimously supportive of the Israeli government and this very narrow interest, and not the kind of democracy movement sweeping the Middle East, including in Israeli and Palestinian land.
And we are talking with Jesse Bacon about the upcoming Move Over AIPAC conference to try to make some changes. And it's a very complicated issue, certainly, Israel, Palestine. It does seem that the Syrians and others very recently did what they could to deflect the people's anger at the government of Syria by focusing on Israel. It seems, at least my impression is, that the move to assault the border of what's now the state of Israel on the Golan Heights was largely backed by Syria. A good 15, 18 people were killed, believe not armed people were killed. And of course, it's very easy for the governments, it has been for a long long time for the largely authoritarian governments of places like Saudi Arabia, formerly Egypt, Lebanon, not so much Jordan, but these other countries to just focus on Israel as the bad guy and take the pressure off themselves, much the way Fidel Castro has done it within his country. It's all the problems are the fault of the U.S. And there it seems like all the problems have said to be the fault of the state of Israel. So do you think there's change going on with that perception because of the Arab Spring right now?
Well, I certainly hope so. I think it's really clear that the Arab Spring shows how much the U.S. and Israel both have backed these dictatorships, even when they were preaching democracy to the region and using that as an excuse for supporting repressive policies. They were backing the worst dictatorships. I mean, that's certainly true in the cases of Egypt and Tunisia, which were the first, I believe, not the last of these dictatorships to fall. Also, you know, nonviolent protest has been going on in Palestinian areas, supported increasingly by Israelis for a long time before this current wave. And so I think that, you know, we shouldn't be surprised as Jewish Americans when people care about people around the world and feel like part of a community. That's one of the wonderful things about the Jewish community, the way that we come to the aid of Jews around the world. And we should not be surprised when people who share a cultural and linguistic heritage of the Arab culture feel connections to each other. That's also a positive thing. And it's true that these governments have paid kind of lip service, but really, if you look at their record, they've cracked down on real support of their populations for Palestinians because they rightly feared that it would attack their own power. And right. I think that it's pretty clear to me that the actual democracy for Palestinians is threatening to dictators around the world and anti-democratic forces, because they're such a powerful symbol. Now, in terms of the folks protesting on Nakba Day, it's Nakba, N-A-K-B-A, it's usually spelled in English.
I see.
You know, many of those people were Palestinians, living in the Palestinian diaspora and refugee communities. And, you know, the response to them, it was even brutal by Israel's recent crackdown, but this kind of thing happens every week in the West Bank. It made the news this time because it was coordinated over Twitter in the way that the other Arab Spring protesters had been, that it took place, you know, all around the region. But, you know, we should realize that it's very common for Israel to open fire on unarmed protesters, mm-hmm. either with rubber-coated bullets or live ammunition or tear gas canisters. That's the focus of my blog, is these on-the-ground reports of these protests. And I see this all the time. It seemed that there was extra panic because of the broad, sweeping nature of the protests on Nakba Day. But it's clear that Israel does not recognize that Palestinians have a right to protest. It treats it like a crime. It treats it like something that you can shoot at people for. And this, I'm hoping that these broader protests show even more attention on what goes on each week in Israel-Palestine.
And we are talking with Jesse Bacon about challenges to the age-old power structure that has been in place, not so much in Israel, but more in the U.S., to really have just an absolute iron grip on Congress. And this is AIPAC, the American-Israeli Public Affairs Committee, certainly I don't think they would even argue that they tend to support the more right-wing of Israeli politics. There's that old saying, you know, you get three Jews together, you get five or six opinions, you know, because there are a lot of parties in the state of Israel. It's not just the right wing, but the right wing has been in power for quite some time. And it does seem that criticizing Israel has been jumped on by AIPAC. I've heard the words, and I'm sure you have too, Jesse, self-hating Jew. If you criticize Israel, you are a self-hating Jew. How well has that worked to stop Jewish dissent within both Israel and the supporters of the state of Israel?
Well, I think it's like a lot of things. It worked really well until it didn't. And just like the strategy of supporting dictators, abroad, the strategy of cracking down on open debate in our Jewish communities and in our political communities at home is really past its expiration date. And I think you're seeing it, you saw it in this recent Tony Kushner episode where he was denied an honorary degree, and there was this huge outcry, and the defense of him was really the same narrow band of people who think of themselves as the majority and were shocked. I mean, you could tell in the response to this member of the CUNY Board of Trustees that he really did not expect this worldwide outcry. Now,
well,
that was...
You got to tell us a little bit of
Tony Kushner, this beloved playwright, deep roots in the Jewish community, huge achievements. But this, again, these are procedures that happen all the time, but it's getting harder and harder to get away with it, I think. And particularly among people my age and younger, I'm kind of the cutoff. I was born 10 years after the 1967 occupation. And for those of us, you know, we've grown up in this different world, and, you know, you can call us self-hating Jews and try to trigger all of our, you know, guilt and things like that, but it's really working less well. I mean, increasingly we have a community that we're taking voice and taking leadership in, and that's just not, even among people who have a different view of Israel, that label just lacks the sting that it used to have. I think there's much more respect among younger Jews for different opinions, and that's why it's so important to us to showcase the work of Young Jewish and Proud, to take leadership in these organizations that, you know, were originally, you know, staffed and personed by baby boomers, and now throughout the Jewish world, you know, the younger folks are starting to come into our power, and I think that we have a much greater, and, you know, I've been blessed with older mentors. I would not be here on the show with you without the work of the people who came before me.
Thank you.
But it's just so much more widely shared among my peers, this sense of, you know, we are believers in democracy first, and we're proud Jews first, and that there's no contradiction between those two things. And we just don't have the same, they don't have the same ability to silence us, because we do have our own communities, our own organizations, even our, you know, increasingly our own synagogues and independent places of worship.
And you can still be a proud Jew. Well, I got to go back just a little bit. Not everybody knows about this Tony Kushner case. I wonder if you could just tell that story just a little bit.
Sure, I would love to. I mean, it was really telling for me. I've been a fan of Tony Kushner since he came to my college in 1996. And he's just, you know, anyone who's seen a play of his or seen him speak has been affected on one level. You know, even it's such emotionally powerful stuff. And so, you know, he's definitely would be on my list if I had an honorary degree to give out to someone.
Yeah.
And we're also proud to have him on the Jewish Voice for Peace Advisory Board because of this incredible record of translating politics into really beautiful, emotional, connecting artwork. And so...
So what happened to him recently?
His recent plays have focused on the conflict in Afghanistan. He has a new play that's up that I haven't seen. It has a great title that I will get wrong, but it's something like The Intelligent Homosexual's Guide to Socialism.
Something like that, right.
Something
right.
to that effect.
Yeah.
But
he got into some...
He got to get this honorary degree, and for the first time, it was from a law school that's part of the CUNY system, and for the first time in its history, we believe, the CUNY Board of Trustees vetoed it. And they did so because of the objections of one person, which is often all it takes, and... He was, you know, he claimed to be speaking as a Jew on this issue. He essentially called Tony Kushner an anti-Semite just for having a different view on Israel. And this is someone, like I said, with deep roots in the Jewish community. So the outrage was instant and immediate. Jewish Voice for Peace was part of a coalition that gathered close to over 5,000 signatures in opposed to the decision. You had people like Barbara Ehrenreich and the author of The English Patient returning their honorary degrees from CUNY. And it was so quick, even more conservative people. And it really showed how narrow the group of people is who want to deny artists their expression, who want to deny debates on campus, all in the name of this kind of, you know, down-the-line slavish suppression of criticism.
And it's interesting, growing up Jewish myself, having born, 27 years before you, there was always pride in Israel. Israel was talked about as part of Jewish identity, not all of Jewish identity, but it was something that was, a safe haven after the Holocaust, obviously. But my parents always stressed that this was the only democracy in the Middle East, and therefore was worth America standing by firmly. Well, I always thought of democracy as something that happens within a republic, or usually, but democracy means a lot of different voices get heard. And it's not, it's the opposite of a dictatorship where there is one voice, one party line that must be followed strictly. And I just wonder how much AIPAC in particular has been like that. Are they favoring a continued democracy in Israel, or has it become kind of something else there?
I think that, you know, there's a number of really great groups working within Israel that are tracking the health of Israeli democracy. And I think, you know, my blog's title is The Only Democracy, and it ends in a question mark. And I think it's the most important aspect of democracy is that it's an ongoing conversation. And so rather than sort of dividing up the world in a kind of Cold War way and saying these people have democracy and these people don't, I think what we've seen in the Arab Spring is how that writes off large numbers of people who are just as capable of standing up for democracy when their moment comes as the rest of us are. I mean, I hope we would defend our democracy with the bravery of the protesters in Egypt and Tunisia and around the Middle East. And so, you know, all of the indicators in the health of Israeli democracy right now are that I can think of, that I observe, that I see coming across my emails and my news feeds and the chats from my friends who are there are negative, I mean, honestly. And the AIPAC just is not built to, they're not built to be a democratic organization. You know, they're built to raise money and give it to people who follow a narrow line. And so it's the kind of antithesis of democracy. And we have our own struggles with this in this country right now because of things like the Citizen United decision, where corporations can give huge amounts of cash. I mean, there's many, you know, narrow forces that have hijacked our democracy. And so that in turn leads to, you know, if you're supporting these narrow interests and you function in an anti-democratic way, it's very natural to support dictatorships, right? They're predictable, like you said. They speak with one voice.
Yes.
They're usually for sale. You can usually get that one voice to say what you want if you give it enough money and cover up its own crimes. And so I think that it's really clear that that democracy is really antithetical to an approach of AIPAC, of the Israeli government right now, because whatever the democratic freedoms of Israeli Jews, and those are also increasingly under attack, you know, it's important to remember that the Palestinians living under occupation have no democratic rights, and they are struggling for them every day in defiance of that, and every week we have these protests across the West Bank, and so it's incredibly moving to me, and it really defies this kind of, these myths that, like, certain people don't want democracy. So I really hope that this is a moment, if you haven't questioned AIPAC's policies before, seeing how much they have supported dictatorships and how wrong they were about Egyptians, about these protests, about the value provided by someone like Hosni Mubarak. I mean, I really think there have to be consequences for being wrong about these things. And if they're wrong about that, how wrong are they about what's good for the Jewish community or what's good for people who feel a connection to Israel?
Well, I've heard a lot of concern about, well, what happens after Mubarak and what happens if the brutal government of Syria falls, that perhaps they'll become religious states as well. And some people have defended Mubarak and the other countries as being at least stable. And so there seems to be some concern in Israel about that. And Jesse, you said that I've had this impression too, that Palestinians' rights, they don't have as much rights as Jewish Israelis. Now, I've heard year after year after year that, well, Palestinians have every right to become Israeli citizens. Do they not? What's your response to that?
They do not. And even because of the way citizenship works within Israel, all citizenships aren't created equal. But if you're a Palestinian in the West Bank and you say, I want to move to Israel, which is, you know, in many cases where their relatives are from, where they may have family now, you're not allowed. You're essentially not allowed to. The rate is effectively zero of Palestinians who can claim Israeli citizenship. Now, on the other side, as a Jewish person, I could go to Israel and claim my citizenship if I wanted to.
Right.
And Israeli Jewish settlers bring their citizenship with them. So once I had that citizenship, if I decided I want to go live in the middle of a Palestinian village in the West Bank, I could do that without losing my Israeli citizenship. And what's more, I would get this whole apparatus of the army to come protect me if I behaved very badly towards my neighbors, and build roads for just me and, you know, my increasing number of fellow settlers. And so there really are not the same rights, and it's just been going on for far too long, and AIPAC is not helping that. I mean, they're a force. They're clearly much better at stopping anything positive from happening than, you know, bringing an end to the resolution of the conflict themselves. And so, and they, you know, like the weapons manufacturers, they succeed based on conflict. I mean, one thing that recently happened where there was this brutal killing of a settler family, including children, and AIPAC sent out a fundraiser within a few hours, and they actually had to apologize for it, which is, you know, very rare for them. And so they, you know, but that should just tell us how much they are profiting from both the deaths and the denial of freedoms to Israelis as well as Palestinians.
Yeah, I have. I was just going to say, I have found it rather amazing that I or you or any Jew from around the world could go to the modern state of Israel and automatically be a citizen. But the people who lived there before, the Palestinians, before the state of Israel was created in 1948, can't do that. I have a little bit of a problem with that as a Jew specifically, and which might lead us into the group of which you're affiliated, Young, Jewish, and Proud. Very interesting title. And, you know, it's so in conflict with what you hear that, oh, you know, if you don't support Israel down the line, whatever they do, you're self-hating. How did Young, Jewish, and Proud come about? And what does that really say about what it means to be Jewish? Is it just, you know, if you support Israel, you know, and are born Jewish, you're Jewish? Or is it something a little deeper than that? Has something to have to do with, you know, how you live your life and the values and traditions that Jews have? Tell us about Young, Jewish, and Proud.
It came out of a leadership institute in New Orleans, sponsored by Jewish Voice for Peace, as a space because, you know, we knew that young people are such a key to this generational shift that's happening in the Jewish community. And then by far the most prominent action in the history of Jewish, you know, in the Jewish Voice for Peace, as well as in Young, Jewish, Proud, was the interruption of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes.
When he said, you know, we knew he was going to talk about delegitimization, this sort of buzzword about, you know, you're if you criticize Israel, you're saying it's not legitimate and you can't do that. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, well, that's fine, but who are the real delegitimizers? And we talked about how these actions of the Israeli government that do more to delegitimize Israel in a day than all the criticism on the internet could in a much longer period. And so you have things like having people sign a loyalty oath to become citizens, or, you know, these settlement projects that I described. And so it's really, but, you know, it's Young, Jewish, and Proud. We're organizing in different cities around the country and really trying to provide, you know, with a community. I mean, for years, some of my deepest ties in the Jewish community are people who I met doing this activism, you know, and we've really, you know, I've been amazed at how people have integrated in and so naturally into the rest of their Jewish practice, whether they're religious or not. You know, it's very clear that if you ask people what makes them Jewish, a commitment to social justice is really high on the list, and that it's, you know, it's much deeper than just supporting a country, you know, a particular government or a particular country. Because at the end of the day, that's a pretty shallow activity. You know, it's cheerleading. It forces you to defend whatever that government is doing, no matter how awful. And but opposing and really grappling with these issues of what does it mean to be Jewish, and what is our relationship to other oppressed groups, to other religious communities, to other other Jews around the world, to Israelis, to Palestinians. Those are really deep questions, and they're really rich. And it's always been, you know, my experience, and I know I'm very lucky. I'm very supported by my family in this work, But I know that that's not the case for all of Young Jewish and Proud. And it's been really important to me that when we say to people to join us and to act with consistency with your own values, which there's just no feeling like that, that we also be able to offer people support. That if indeed you're getting flack from your own community, from your family, we're there to talk about it. And that's why Jewish Voice for Peace also launched a rabbinical council. The same kind of ideas that rabbis were wanting a place to speak out, both to the broader movement, to have their voice, you know, their distinctive knowledge and experiences be part of this broader movement, and also to sort of support each other, you know, support colleagues who have been targeted for taking these bold stands for their values. And so it's the same with Young Jewish and Proud, and it's been really great. I mean, already I felt so much community from this effort, and that's the best kind of activism in the end, is activism that's really grounded in who you are, but reaches out to people all across the world who are very different.
And I think that people get that, even if they're not with you. People, you know, if they pay attention to politics, even just a little bit, people get a sense of authenticity. Are you coming from a place of true ethics, you know, a sense of true justice, or is it, you know, something else? Is it about money? Is it about power? People can tell. And certainly it wasn't about money and power when Young Jewish and Proud interrupted Netanyahu. I believe that was an APEC gathering. It's on YouTube. It's pretty impressive. You know, people could say, oh, it's so impolite while the guy was speaking to interrupt him. Tell us about what that was and if most people who participated in that disruption of the speech felt good about it.
I mean, I think that those people will never forget it. And some of them were new activists. Some of them had been involved in protests for years. And I think wherever you were, even people who didn't participate themselves were changed by it. And what was really striking to me was the reaction of people in the hall, you know, people who were there. It actually wasn't an APAC gathering. It was the Jewish Federation. So it was, you know, all these Jewish community representatives from around the country, mm-hmm. and yet the speaker's positions from the stage about Israel were down-the-line APAC-style politics. And so, you know, once those people stood up, lots of people who weren't at the point of being able to stand up themselves saw that and thought, you know, those people are more like me than this kind of monologue going on stage. And however, you know, it really crystallized the differences. And so even if you, you know, weren't ready to sign the Young Jewish and Proud petition that day, you really saw about, you know, you couldn't help but be moved, I think, by the your peers standing up, or if you were older, someone concerned about the voice of youth in the Jewish community as well. And it just was really, like you said, it was a very authentic gesture, I think, and one that, you know, it continues to get news coverage. I mean, months and months and months later, in our fractured world of, you know, the 24-hour news cycle, right. it's a pretty enduring gesture. And I think, you know, it's the question of how do we build from that into really supporting people where they live and building up our communities and connecting to other people. There was the great group in Gaza whose manifesto echoed so many shared values in such a much braver conditions, the Gaza Youth Breakout. People should look that up as well.
Oh, I don't know about that. But this one I saw, it was about, as you said, the question of delegitimizing Israel. Young people kept standing up and interrupting with signs that said various different things. You remember better than I. I'm sure I've only seen it once. Certain specific actions that are delegitimizing Israel. They're saying it wasn't criticism of Israel that's delegitimizing Israel, but that Israel is delegitimizing itself. Is that right?
Yeah, and it was a great message. And as you said, it was, you know, this sort of I think it echoed what a lot of people were feeling. And that's why it had so much life and endurance as an example. And to me, it was really, you know, watching it live and knowing that these protests were planned, but not knowing how it was going to happen or what the response was going to be. You know, it just was a sense of how the people can have power. Even ordinary people can take power in a situation from one of the most powerful people in the world, Benjamin Netanyahu.
Yes.
In that room, he, for a brief moment, he didn't have the power, and it was a really great feeling, and one that I'll always carry forward with me.
That is a great feeling. It's Ed. I can just imagine. You can see there, there's somebody who believes he is invincible and just has all the power in the world. Suddenly, by a bunch of, you know, just average people standing up, his power is kind of pulled out from under him just a little bit. Now, if you just tuned in, Bert Cohen here. This is the Bert Cohen Show. We're talking with Jesse Bacon, who is the editor of the Only Democracy? Blog and a member of Young Jewish and Proud. We're talking about, a lot of younger Jewish people, and I'm sure older people as well, but mostly young people. It's funny how young people often lead political change. Speaking out about the amazing power of AIPAC. It seems like even the most liberal member of Congress kind of generally kowtows to whatever AIPAC has to say. And that's starting to change. And I know a lot of Jewish members of Congress have been that way. And Benjamin Netanyahu seems to be only too happy to equate the Jewish people around the world with the modern state of Israel, that they are one in the same. Has, you know, in looking back to the various, the rise of anti-Semitism, has it, the anti-Semitism been against Jews who criticize Israel? Or could it be said that the state of Israel, with some of its more apartheid, racist policies, and I know people would disagree on that, but I think there's a lot of evidence that Israel itself may have caused harm to Jews around the world as people around the world confuse what Israel is doing with all Jews. So reaction to Netanyahu saying the Jewish people and Israel are one in the same. And, you know, a lot of Jews, it seems to me, around the world are blamed. You know, if that's true, that all Jews are in lockstep with the state of Israel, then frankly, it's not surprising there's antipathy. But being Jewish is not the same as supporting this political state that calls itself Israel. Your response?
Yeah, and I think people, you know, increasingly get that. But that's, to me, why this work is so important. I mean, I'm in it as a universalist, as a believer in democracy, and I'm also in it as a Jew. I want it to be clear that there's a distinction between the actions of the government and the state of Israel. And I think people are pretty quick to get that, too, because, you know, if you've been an American in the last 10 years and you've traveled around the world, including the places that have been treated badly as a result of American foreign policy, you know, you get a firsthand lesson in people's ability to differentiate. And I think people have the same capacity with regard to Jews, but it's important that we reach out to them. You know, I never want to blame Jews for anti-Semitism. I think, you know, like, people, you know, are not responsible for their own discrimination. But at the same time, we should be aware, if we know that there's going to be negative effects towards Jews, towards Israelis, towards other people of a policy, we should really think about that carefully and not just use it to score political points the way that, you know, is going to go on at this AIPAC policy conference. And so I think that people are really, I am an optimist about people's ability to make distinctions, but I also believe it's very important both to call out anti-Semitism when we see it in our own movements, in our own communities, and also to make it clear that there is a distinction, that the people, you know, I mean, the whole thing of living in a democracy and having the privileges I have is that I, you know, have a lot of means to make it clear when someone's not speaking for me. And it's much harder to do that under, you know, under an actual dictatorship. And so I want to be sure, I'm the father of a three-year-old daughter, and I want to be really clear that, you know, I anticipate at some point getting asked by her, you know, what I did with myself during this time period. I think future generations like hers, if the current generation is more and more skeptical, imagine what she's going to say when she asks how we spent this time period where, you know, the conditions were getting so worse, and at the same time there were these beautiful examples of these democratic movements. You know, what did we do? What did we do to help them? And I also want to, you know, it's why it's so important to me that we fight. We've decided to call it blue watching. You heard it here first on the show, probably. It's based on the idea of whitewashing, or also there was recently an article in Time magazine about pinkwashing.
I don't know what either one of those is.
Okay, so the idea is, I should explain,
sure,
is pinkwashing is using the achievements of the queer community, the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered community in Israel to hide or cover up oppression of Palestinians, as if one canceled the other out. And there was a great Time magazine feature on it that they did a wonderful job of explaining it, if you're interested. And we've decided that this, you know, I've been studying this phenomenon and thinking back about this larger phenomenon of blue washing, of trying to put a Jewish symbol on oppression. And there's really, you know, you talk about an unjust anti-Semitic act. I mean, that really distorts, you know, a religion and a culture that I'm so proud of. And so we're our focus on in this Move Over AIPAC protest is really going to be countering that that blue washing effect and really putting Jewish values and Jewish actions on very different protests, on very different actions that are, you know, connected to people around the world in support of democratic movements and for free and open Jewish communities of the kind that I would like my daughter to one day be able to live in.
That's always a good motivation, isn't it? having young kids and thinking about what they're going to think about it, for sure. And I wonder if, well, your press release, the press release from Jewish Voice for Peace, calls on the Israeli government to negotiate directly with the elected representatives of the Palestinians. And we all know that in the Gaza area, the elected representatives of the Palestinians are Hamas. On the West Bank, I believe it's the Palestinian Authority. And Hamas is, I believe, called for, at least I've been told, that Hamas calls for the destruction of Israel. So you're suggesting that Israel negotiate with people whose avowed goal is to destroy Israel? Yes?
Yeah, I understand that can sound a little off, but really when you look at the history of conflicts around the world, they're negotiated by the former adversaries when they end. And you hope for as just as negotiation as possible. I mean, that's why we support the values of international law and human rights, because we think they really can allow us to evaluate negotiations to see if they're likely to produce a just outcome. But that doesn't mean that you get to pick who you negotiate with in almost any case, or that you get to pick who the people, who your neighbors vote for. And so that often means, I mean, and that will mean the same thing for Palestinians if, you know, certainly Israeli political parties are descended from Israeli militias, that pre-state Israeli militias. And so there's, you know, it's this idea that Israel gets to pick who it negotiates with. We would not allow in any other conflict in the world for that to happen. And you know, parties have negotiated peace with each other in places like Ireland without ever renouncing their ideology. I mean, it's much less important what people believe than what they do. And there's certainly, I mean, I would not want to live under a Hamas rule. I'm not a supporter of them. But at the same time, I think that you have to see them as part of Palestinian society, as an evolving group with evolving aims in the world. And, you know, to veto or block any segment of Palestinian society from negotiations is to make those negotiations less effective. And indeed, we've seen the peace process now going on for years and years and years without any results, and or negative results, in fact. And that's why people are increasingly turning to the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, is because they're wanting some way around the world to participate, to take leadership from Palestinians, and to take nonviolent action that supports a just resolution and not just more endless negotiations that are kind of scripted, you know, by groups like AIPAC.
And talk about boycott. What does that mean? I mean, there hasn't. I don't know how much actual action there's been about boycotting. What is being boycotted, and toward what purpose?
Well, one of the great one of the sponsors of Move Over AIPAC is Code Pink, and they have a really wonderful campaign to boycott Ahava makeup. And it's great because Ahava is made in a settlement. It's environmentally destructive, and at the same time, it targets, you know, it's the name means love. It's you know, natural mud. It's very much targeting this progressive consumer base, and so you can really do a lot of great creative actions. That I was part of a live, for people who don't use Twitter, Twitter uses these things called hashtags where you can take part in a conversation with people all over the world. And this company that gives out gift boxes was giving away a prize of Ahava if you tweeted your question to the, you know, using this particular tag. And so, of course, that was just an open invitation for all of us to ask things like, you know, I chipped a nail, you know, oppressing a Palestinian. What should I use to fix it? Or, you know, there's hilarious tweets on there, but very serious topic, right?
Yes.
And so that it's you know, a chance to do really creative activism. My own organization, Jewish Voice for Peace, has a campaign. This is a divestment campaign against this pension giant TIAA-CREF, which is, again, a very socially responsible, its motto is for the greater good. It's held by a lot of helping professionals, professors, social work, and teachers, and they have companies that profit from the Israeli occupation. So that's really our focus at Jewish Voice for Peace, is products that are made in settlement, companies that profit from the 1967 occupation. There are groups who do other tactics, who boycott other products like hummus that support the Israeli army in some way or are more tied in with the Israeli state. And as long as it's nonviolent and doesn't use, you know, I think it's all, everything that people should try is good as long as it doesn't, you know, use violent tactics.
Sure.
I think it's, there's room for different approaches, let's put it that way. And people do have, I understand people have negative associations with boycott, and I think it's important to stress that nobody's boycott anything just because it's Jewish or something like that. It really has to have a tie-in to the Israeli government, or in our case, to the 1967 occupation apparatus. And those campaigns are increasingly successful around the world. You know, companies have lost billions of dollars in contracts because of their association with occupation and discrimination.
Oh, absolutely. And it did. There's no question the boycott helped bring down the racist apartheid government of South Africa many years ago. It was clearly effective. And, you know, I know that there are a lot of groups, about 100 peace and justice groups, including Code Pink, Jews Say No, Interfaith Peace Builders, supporting the Move Over APAC gathering in Washington. I didn't see J Street on that list. J Street is a new group they say they're pro-Israel, pro-peace. And they have a big ad out in, I believe, the New York Times calling for a return to the 1967 borders and a recognition of a Palestinian state. And again, you know, being Jews, we have lots of different opinions. What about J Street? Are they basically on the same page, or... What's your take on that?
The distinction between J Street's approach is that they are, in general, opposed to sort of things that create consequences for Israel. So boycotts, divestment, sanctions, chiefly among them. They did have space at their conference for a debate on boycott, divestment, and sanctions, and they invited our executive director to speak at it. So they do support an open debate on the question, but they, as a group, do not endorse any campaigns like that. And I think, you know, it was, I you know, can't speak for them, I'm not on their staff, but I assume it was some concern about being engaged in groups that do, or, you know, targeting, they are a lobbying group, so I think it's, you know, I think they have a different relationship to APAC than people who are opposed to that. I mean, we do lobbying as well, but, so I think there are a lot of different options, and it certainly shows, you know, the great growth in activism around this issue, and you know, there are a lot of groups out there, and you should find the one that you feel like is doing the most kind of tangible, effective work to bring change on this issue, because it is so urgent. And you know, I think there's just, I have to say, speaking personally, there's something to be said for getting to go and confront people directly. I mean, I think you have to have it takes a lot of different kinds of,
yes,
of movements and community building to do this, but I definitely think there's a role still for public protest, you know, visibly speaking out and standing up.
Indeed. And I before we got too far away from the boycott and divestment, is there a way on the good old internet to find out what products might be boycottable, if that's a word? I'll make it
there
up.
Totally is. There's this great site called whoprofits.org. I got to meet the founder at our Jewish Voice for Peace's meeting. She's really wonderful, Dalit Baum. And you can really find out, you know, you can really, it's a great, you know, in the great tradition of the internet, it's kind of an open site. Like, you can ask your question, hey, what about this company? You can share knowledge you have. They recently put out a report that said that all Israeli wines, all wines made in Israel, rely on settlement grapes. And so there's right now there's not an option for, you know, all of the Israeli wines right now are supporting the occupation. And so it's, you know, just a good place for information like that. And, you know, certainly if you're interested in the TIA CREF campaign, our website, wedivest.org, lists the five companies that we're targeting, and you're, you know, we welcome people to either join that campaign. You don't have to be Jewish to do so. Just concerned about your pension dollars or, you know, your educational institution or whatever it is, not supporting occupation. And so, yeah, it's great. I mean, it's wonderful to be part of this internet community around this issue. As hard as it is and as tough as it can be to do this work, we're really fortunate to have these tools at our disposal.
That's
great examples, you know, including famously the Egyptian and Tunisian protests and others about how to use them effectively. So
yeah, it's amazing.
Definitely people should get on the internet and check things out. And
what were the two things again?
So wedivest.org.
Yeah, and what was the other one?
And Who Profits. I'm going to call the website up, make sure I'm telling you the right address for Who Profits.
All right, and we are talking
WhoProfits.org, yeah.
WhoProfits.org. We're talking with Jesse Bacon, who is the editor of The Only Democracy? Blog and a member of Young, Jewish, and Proud. And let me ask, it's been going on for a long time. Israel is a Jewish state. There aren't that many religious states in the world. And, you know, certainly J Street is now calling for a two-state solution. Even some more conservative Israelis are recognizing that there needs to be a two-state solution. It's rather difficult with building roads into the settlements that are only for Jewish Israelis, the loyalty oath, the walls and things like that. My question is, can there still be a two-state solution, or might it be too late? Might the only answer for peace and justice to be a secular state in which all are equal under the law? Difficult question. What do you think, Jesse?
Well, Jewish Voice for Peace, one of the things that sort of distinguishes us is that we don't call specifically for there to be a one-state or a two-state solution. We call for any solution that supports human rights and equality. So if you can do that within a separate, two separate states or 12, then great. Or if you do it within one, the most important thing to us is the sort of values behind it. Now, that said, it seems clear that we won't get a two-state solution the way we've been trying to do it. And so, you know, there are people in our group who have personal preferences all along the spectrum and all along the range, or no preferences at all. And I think that what's important is that we recognize, as Jewish Americans, as connected as we feel to this issue, which is great and should be nurtured, you know, we're not going to be on the ground determining it. And so it's important to us that we, in the end, once justice has been done and people can meet as equals, that those we firmly believe that they are as capable of anyone else as coming up with arrangements that will allow people to continue to live together justly. So we don't take a specific position, and that alienates us from people who are really committed to a particular situation, but I think they see the value in it of a big coalition and a place for people to come together and, you know, work with people across kind of maybe different ideas about this.
Well, certainly changes are happening, and we'll see what the position of the U.S. is in coming weeks on this. Very, very interesting time, really at a crossroads. If people want to find out more about what various websites, Jewish Voice for Peace, the Only Democracy? Blog, what other places on the internet can people go for more information about what you're up to?
Well, I'll also add muzzlewatch.com, which is Jewish Voice for Peace's I call it the Big Sister blog. It was started earlier and really is a great project that focuses on these instances where debate is shut down around Israel in the United States, and it's had a great effect. You know, it was one of the places where the Tony Kushner story broke, and, you know, there's been some great victories, as well as it's always a victory just to know about this stuff, since it's so dependent on kind of behind closed doors activity. If you go on The Only Democracy, you can see sort of our links to, we would not be able to do this work without great folks on the ground in Israel, Palestine, doing this incredible reporting that, you know, again, thanks to technology, you can now access. And so those are places like 972 Magazine, which is 972mag.org.
And just go for Jewish Voice
Village,
for Peace,
where many of the protests have gone on. They have their own website. So, you know, the caution is, of course, not to get overwhelmed by all this information. I mean, you can have such immediate experiences and gain so much knowledge, but, you know, you can also can get kind of overwhelming, just this sort of flood of information. So it's good to have strategies to kind of remind yourself of what's important, you know, that really I think most people have, their basic values are what you need to be a guideline. And then the question is just how to live out those values and get the information you need. But you know, there's the values of human rights and equality that we all share. And so I just, you know, would recommend, I mean, that's what's so great about having support, having community, and that they can really, we can take care of each other doing this difficult work.
All right, Jesse Bacon.
I anticipate it going on for a while, but it's great, you know, to live at such an exciting time.
Thanks very much.
When things are really changing.
For being with us, Jesse Bacon, Jewish Voice for Peace. Thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Occupation started when Palestine was left brokenhearted. Hands down, you won't believe the way they laid their wrath on her. 6 feet under is where they left us. So bad, the way that they were killing us. Too bad, we're not afraid to die when bombs fall from the sky.
Can't explain.
I never thought that we were gonna lose so bad.
They're all insane.
There's got to be a way.
All our houses,
Palestine,
ripped from all the corpses.
Tough luck,
they had to have the guns when all we have are rights.
All day,
they're killing little babies.
So we're
defending our families.
They said
that we were out of line. Who's wrong? Who's right this time?
Can't explain.
I never thought that we were gonna lose so bad.
They're all insane.
There's got to be.
Should be scared.
Shit.